Good morning, my dear brothers and sisters in Christ. Good morning, everybody. This is Friday, August 12, the first lecture of the day. My name is Annie. I'm a seminarian from the People's Republic. And my topic today is Lot's Daughters, California, of course. And my topic today is Lot's Daughters, Tricksters or Victims. Very short 3 years ago that all of us, Jen, Sage, Carla, all of us, plus about 55 others, were all in Old Testament class first semester of seminary. And Dr. Kwan, our professor, knew full well that he had students in the class of varying degrees of biblical knowledge. Some were quite versed, and others of us, of course, knew what the outside of a Bible at least looked like. And before the first class ended, Dr. Kwan became convinced that probably 57 out of 60 of us were in the latter category. At the beginning of the second class, Jeffrey asked us, "Is there anyone here who has ever heard the story of Adam and Eve?" Trust me. Throughout the course of the semester, there were names of biblical characters. I don't remember anyone ever named Tom or Jim or Mike. Someone would always ask Dr. Kwan to please spell that name for us, whether it was the name of a person or the name of a location. He was always very obliging and incredibly kind to all of us. When we got to the book of Job, he asked us, "Do I need to spell that for you?" And so on it went. When we were told that this week's lectures was going to be families of the Bible, the first thought for most of us, and the second thought, and the third thought, and the fourth thought, etc., was, what in the world do we know about this topic? Well, I thought, nothing. And then I remembered a wonderful story that I had read a long time ago of Harry and Jack Cohen. As you remember, Harry Cohen was president of Columbia Studios for a period of time. And Cohen's brother Jack once suggested to Harry, "Let's do a biblical epic." "Well, what do you know about the Bible?" Harry said. "I'll bet you $50 you don't even know the Lord's Prayer." So after a moment, Jack said, "Now I lay me down to sleep." Well, Harry pulled out $50 from his pocket and said, "Well, I'll be darned. I didn't think you'd know it." So, after remembering that little story, I thought, well, at least we know the Lord's Prayer, so we have something going. Again, coming from Berkeley, there is no way that one could talk about Lot's Daughters without a couple of thoughts from the feminist perspective. There are various lenses through which one can view Lot's daughters as women of the ancient world. The feminist interpretations say clearly something about the human community and the experience of what it means to be specifically female. Some writers had looked at Lot's daughters as tricksters. And as we know, the Israelites looked at their ancestors and also at themselves as underdogs. And one of the way the marginalized and those on the outskirts of society confront the powers that be is sometimes through trickery and deception. The daughters here work behind the scenes to accomplish their goals. They demonstrate an ethically questionable power to achieve success in the form of male children. A central conviction within feminist theology is the conviction that women's perspective is to be taken seriously. The point being that being female is as much predominant within the human experience as being male. Throughout history, reproduction has defined the parameters of a woman's life. The importance of a woman's identity has a great deal to do with a people's survival. The women of Genesis were creators of transition. Women were marginal in terms of economic and political authority. And yet, paradoxically, their roles as people in between can be powerful for the development of the story of the Israelite culture. Women succeed behind the scenes, and their power is in the private realm. Women evoke sympathy as those whose rights are unstable and always at risk of being abrogated. It always seems to be an elusive line between the trickster and the victim. I point out Tamar, Rachel, Dinah, Hagar as examples. Without Eve, the present world would not be. Without Rebecca, Jacob would not have fathered the people of Israel. After the daughters conceive their sons, in other words, they have fulfilled their purpose, they recede into the background of the story and are never mentioned again. Yet even though nameless and forgotten, they are important chains in the birth of the 12 tribes. Perhaps to their credit, they actually do achieve eternal success in that they are mothers of nations. The story of Lot and his daughters, on one level, is the story of superficial religion. In the Arcana 2468, the form and the nature of the religion of Moab and the children of Ammon becomes clear, and it is a clear description of their origin. Generally, they are people whose worship is external and to some extent appears to be holy, but is not internal. They are also people who accept whatever relates to the external worship as being good and true, but reject as worthless everything that relates to inner worship. This type of worship and religion exists for people who consider themselves to be superior as compared to other people. They may be like a piece of fruit that looks on the outside to be quite appealing, and yet on the inside is rotten and of no worth. A human being, too. Who may appear on the outside to be loving and caring, and yet on the inside is concerned only for his own welfare and for what he can get out of other people. And this not only exists within the religious realm, but also we see it very much in society in general and of late within the corporate world, where books were cooked and pension funds were lost and retirement plans were lost and stockholders took a big hit and many, many people lost their jobs. It isn't this way usually at first, but people allow themselves to be impressed with what people call the good. And so whatever false ideas they imagine to be true, they are believed at the beginning, whatever is false ideas later on is imagined at the beginning to be true and to be good. This happens when people scorn the deeper things of worship and are ruled by self-love. Worship is purely external, and this is represented by Lot himself. So both of Lot's daughters become pregnant by their father, Genesis 19:36. This is a story that is about human sexual and behavioral corruption, not to mention the descriptions of incredible divine wrath. In looking at the Swedenborgian commentaries at the SHS library in preparation for this, I really did not find very much on this particular passage in the way of commentaries, and I thought that was interesting. Swedenborg himself does not really go into it much, He does this in a somewhat summary fashion, and he speaks about things that, quote, shock people's minds and offend their ears. But as we know, when we read the Bible, we're not reading a book of nice people and nice stories and nice events. We have seen this in all of today's lectures, and it's a story about human life and all of its joy and troubles and wrath and deception and dishonesty and the good and the bad. When Jesus was here on earth, he also dealt with the good and the bad. This story does have a deeper meaning, however, and it deals with those who think that religion is just a matter of external worship, without any deeper meaning of love and understanding any notions of justice. The story of Lot and his daughters is symbolic of those who practice this kind of a religion. In reading from Swedenborg, we get descriptions almost as colorful of the nature of people who make a great outward show of religion, but inwardly are corrupt and foul. You might recall that old country song about a love on Sunday and foreclosure on Monday. Jesus talked about the scribes and the Pharisees and those who knew the law and taught the law, and they knew it very, very well. And yet they were very superficial in their application of the law. They did not live and they did not walk what they taught. They engaged in corruption and in profiteering and abused in many ways their positions of authority. Swedenborg would call this ruled by self-love. Swedenborg has often been accused of being anti-Jewish, and that was certainly the sentiments of his day at his time. But I also recall in some of the readings that I have read up to date, he was also hard on the Christian church, and he was hard on lots and lots of folks, not just the Jews. But you do have to remember that the Jewish religion was the predominant religion of the time, and being the predominant religion of its time, it does lend itself to whatever corruption there might come about. And there have always been, in all times, people that are greedy and filled with self-love and only out for themselves. We have seen this in the last 20, 30 years with some of these televangelists who have dominated the airwaves, radio, television, and have asked for considerable sums of money to keep their ministry going, and many people have turned over their entire life savings, as we know, and found out that these folks themselves did not walk the talk. I think the more important story in all of this is that the story of Lot, while it can be applied to religions, to churches, to corporations, to all institutions, can also be applied to ourselves. And that at many times we also are living a religion that is superficial. I know many times going to church and, please, let this be fast church, God. And many of us thinking, okay, please let this be over. This is Sunday, tomorrow is work. We have loads of laundry to do, we have ironing to do, we have grocery shopping to do, and everyone is making their little list of things that they must do. This is the women, of course. The men are thinking, boy, I hope I get to that golf course before Harry gets there. But that's not for us to say today. It's not just limited to Jews and to Christians. It's a human curse. And the real point of the story is not for us or for anyone else to provide ammunition for themselves and denigrating the character of another, but for us to be conscious of our own faults and our own ways that may not be particularly in line with the way things should be. It should serve as an object lesson to us when we are tempted to act in a similar manner. This story, and I think a great many other stories within the Bible, are stories about people. There are stories about people in the ancient world, and there are stories that are about people of us living today. We should not point the finger of blame, and that if we do point the finger of blame, the only ones we should be pointing it at is ourselves. This doesn't mean that we should ignore corruption. It just means that when we see it, perhaps we should do something about it. And so one of my questions today to you folks is, what are some of the things that we can do? What do we do when we have a corporation like Enron and WorldCom and some of those other kinds of things, which we feel are so removed from us? What do we do? And on a much smaller level, what do we do in our own communities when we see this? In a small community where there may be a mayor or just a couple of councilmen or whatever, what do we do when we see corruption? What do we do when it's the individual across the street? What do we do when we may come in drunk at night and our children see us or something like that? What do we do? I think that's the really important message here is not just the story of Lot and the story of other Bible stories, but how this applies to our own lives. How do we take the lessons here when we leave this camp today and go out and lead our own lives? What do we do about it? So the ultimate question here is our own spiritual worth and our own spiritual growth. The primary theme of this story is rescue and salvation. Whether Lot was saved because he was indeed a good man, which of course we all know is perhaps somewhat questionable, is not really the issue here. Or was he really saved because God acquiesced to Abraham's request? The issue is good and evil, and they must always be separate entities in order to protect what is good. We don't know what is good unless we know what is evil. Swedenborg tells us that God is always reaching out to us. He does not wish anyone to turn away from him. And yet, we are all free to choose our lives and to choose our loves and to choose what we abhor. Swedenborg emphasized that God wishes eternal life for all of his children, but that if people are to be human and to be responsive, they clearly need to have spiritual freedom. Whether Lot deserved what happened to him or not, whether he deserved to be saved, we all know that indeed he was saved. And we know what happened to his wife when she looked back. The undeserving people that we are can also be saved. But we must always be cognizant of the downstream consequences of looking back. There is no limit to divine compassion and mercy, and all we have to do is ask for it. At this time, I would like to ask if there are any questions and comments, criticisms, whatever, from the audience. Lee?
There we go. One thing I find fascinating about the story is the daughter's statement that there's no man to go in with us according to the way of all the world and all of that. Well, they have just lost their, I don't know if there was their husbands or their significant others, they have just lost in the conflagration. So presumably they're feeling a bit alone at this point. And they are sitting up in a cave with their father. And so I suppose they might feel that way, but it strikes me as somewhat similar to somebody, you know, 20, 21 years old, and they're saying, you know, I don't have a boyfriend or I don't have a girlfriend and I'm never going to get married. Well, there are a few years ahead of them at that point in which something could happen, but I think part of, in a sense, the wrongness of the daughters was thinking things are always going to be the way they are now. there's no men around us right now. We just lost the ones that we had, and so we got to act right now and do something about it.
I appreciate that, Lee, and I think that's a very important point. Given the tenderness of age, I find it especially difficult to find blame with the daughters, and that's why tricksters, yes, but perhaps also victims. And so thank you, Lee. George?
You know, there's a real ambivalence there, though, because the other side of their motivation is to provide descendants for Lot. This is a patrilineal structure. And if they marry other people, that's the end of Lot's line, because they go off, then become part of another line.
Exactly.
So in that sense, they're sacrificing themselves for the sake of their father's patriarchy.
Exactly.
In a way. And the Semitic custom of, you know, you read Osama bin Laden, that's Osama, son of, and the patrilineal tracing
exactly.
is very strong.
Right.
And I have a sneaking suspicion, incidentally, part of the background of the whole idea of apostolic succession. You pass this on from generation to generation.
Absolutely. Thank you, George.
I'm wondering if Lot is representative of external worship, what Lot's daughters represent, and what is the correspondential meaning of their ancestors then?
Well, I think that, like I mentioned with Lot, there were a lot of questions that the commentators did not touch on, and some of the criticisms I read was that he himself was not a good guy because of what he was willing to do with his daughters when it came to the two messengers, presumably the evening before, and his leaving of Zoar because he was afraid to go there, to remain there, and yet he was told to go there. What is all of that about? The idea of the cave, the correspondence of that is that, as you know, caves are dark places, they're hidden. He was out in the open, and then he goes into a place that is of darkness. And that is the correspondence that I came across regarding the cave. I believe that Lot's daughters, issue of their father, were very much of the same makeup that he was. And I think that if they had not done what they had, the present world wouldn't be as it is now. And if one assumes that things happened because they couldn't happen any other way, then it's difficult to find any interpretations other than what we give them for things.
One thought that just occurred to me is that external worship does not connect with the inner and the divine the way inner worship would, and therefore doesn't lead to further developments to the extent that it would. And the fact that Lot's daughters slept with their own father and produced offspring in that way could have something to do with, you know, what does external worship produce, perhaps more of the same rather than deeper insights. If we're just going through the motions, where does that really lead?
Exactly.
If the feminine represents the love of something and Lot's daughters represent the love of external worship, then turning to external worship to preserve itself, as Lee says, rather than seeking some other source of inspiration and continuity.
I'm sorry to go back to literal because I prefer the spiritual, but one point I find interesting is that they said the issue of Lot and his daughters was the Moabites and was it Ammonites?
Or, yes.
Which I believe were enemies of Israel, so they could claim to their enemies, "Oh, you're all sons and daughters of an incestuous relationship," which is putting it nicely. I'm sure they would rant and rave a lot more nastily. So that might have some literal part of the story. And it's interesting that they had just come. The small, it says city in some translations of Zoar was spared, and you would imagine there were people there, and they had remembered to take wine with them and for their father. So they, as Lee said, they seemed a little bit over-eager because they should have known there were other men in the world. It's just they wanted it right now.
Exactly, exactly. Thank you. Lee.
I was hoping somebody would bring up the matter of incestuous relationships and pointing the finger, because there's a wonderful story, I shouldn't call it wonderful, hidden in Genesis chapter 38 about Judah and Tamar, who was his daughter-in-law, and it's too long to tell the whole story, but you can read it for yourself in Genesis 38. It turns out that the two primary sons of Judah through which his line was called were born of an incestuous relationship between Judah and his daughter-in-law. And so the Jews were really not in a very good position to point fingers if that's what they wanted to do. And if they really wanted to do that, they wouldn't have included the other story. I find it fascinating that that story is in there. It has been an occasion for Christians and others to point fingers at Jews, which I don't think is any better than Jews pointing fingers at Moabites and Ammonites.
Exactly.
But one thing I find fascinating about the biblical story is that it tends not to varnish things that we today would varnish.
Exactly.
And according to biblical scholarship, all these stories were written down much later than the fact. So they would have been writing down the story of Judah and Tamar the same time they were writing down the story of Moab and Ammon.
Exactly. Exactly. Thank you, Lee. Gardner.
I have a question that perhaps only you can answer, being a student in Berkeley. It's a difficult.
The People's Republic. Excuse me.
And it's a. The question goes like this: given my understanding that biblical criticism and historical understandings and feminist perspectives and whatnot are the accepted ways of understanding the biblical narrative and perhaps even successfully passing courses. Now that may be overstated, and you could correct me. Now, if that were, given that's the case, and now, secondly, given that Swedenborgian interpretation of the scriptures is based on the fact that, A, historically, Swedenborg would not have been a biblical scholar in that way. He would not have understood the Bible critically, as that field had not yet been established. There was biblical literalism, which he abhorred, and there was a biblical dismissal, the dismissal of the Bible.
Exactly.
So he had those two to look at. Mm-hmm. Okay, now third, there is heavily implied, and yet now to make explicit, that Swedenborg completely accepted the entire biblical narrative as a whole, of a single cloth, and that it was, in my words or modern language, it was symbolic of human interior life. It was the symbol of the development of the psychology and the spirituality of a human being, to set that in modern language. Mm-hmm. And that as such, it is a sacred document, a mirror of the human condition from an interior perspective, and then, of course, the life that flows from that. Now, my question is, how is that view, the sacred dimension of the scriptures, accepted in an environment such as the one in which you find yourself in Berkeley?
Well, in our Old Testament class, there was no discussion about intermeaning, spiritual meaning. And in fact, at the end of the course, Dr. Kwan told us not to worry about any of this, that the Old Testament was merely the story of ancient peoples as they live their lives and come to know God, period. And it is only within the Swedenborgian classes themselves that we were given to understand that there really was a spiritual meaning, that we were never informed in our Old Testament regarding the inner meaning of the Noah story. We were just informed that it didn't really happen, folks. And the creation stories. We were also very much imbued with the Gilgamesh and the other creation stories, and not just the one that was found in the Bible, but others of other ancient folks. And the focus at Berkeley, within all the seminaries that are within the consortium, is of a feminist perspective, of a gay and lesbian perspective, of a liberation theology, and of a womanist theology, almost to the exclusion, I think, of practically anything else. Lana, I don't know if you can also attest to that, but that's been my experience with my 3 years there so far.
I'd just like to check one point there. I don't think Swedenborg took the entire biblical narrative is whole cloth. I mean, there are a number of Old Testament books which he did not consider to have continuous spiritual sense, and a number of the New Testament books which do not have continuous spiritual sense. I guess I would also say maybe that's why the Swedenborg House of Studies has been welcomed so enthusiastically into the PSR community, that they're bringing a sense of spirituality to the Bible that has heretofore been missing.
Absolutely, absolutely. And due to folks like Carla and Jen and Sage and some of the others, those folks that were just ordained at convention a couple of months ago, they have been very instrumental in pointing these spiritual meanings out to any student who wishes to hear them. And it is through them that I came to this denomination. And I, quite frankly, I had no idea that the Noah story was anything other than a little story. And in reading these things, I thought, wow, you guys got to tell people this stuff. You know, and so we do take the opportunity when it arises in our classes to present the inner meaning, the spiritual meaning. And other folks are as amazed as some of us were when we first heard it. Lee.
I'm reading right now a book called Reading the Bible Again for the First Time, Taking the Bible Seriously but Not Literally by Marcus J. Borg. I forget which seminary he's a professor at. But I find it fascinating, and it, in response to Gard, what I've found so far is that he's very well aware of the generally made distinctions between literalistic fundamentalist readings of the Bible and what he calls a historical, and in his case, metaphorical approach. And what I find fascinating is that he's willing to read the Bible metaphorically and is very explicit about that the Bible is not meant to be taken literally in many instances, and that many of its stories are not binding or are not true as they were told, not literally true as they were told, but are true at a deeper level. What I have found lacking already is the concept of the Bible being able to be the Word of God even if it's not literally true, which I was a little surprised at. I kind of expected that he would be able to say, God had, you know, produced this book and enfolded these deeper meanings in it. But so far, that's not what he's saying. And I still agree with you. We've got to tell people about this stuff. And I sort of want to write Marcus Borg a letter or send him a book or something like that and say, how about this idea that there is a human side to the Bible? That's quite true. There is also a divine side to the Bible. And in fact, the process of revelation is one of making an interface between the two. That there has to be the human element or we couldn't understand it, but there also is the divine element within the human, like the gem in its matrix, to use Swedenborg's metaphor. And so I'm finding in this book, he seems to be one of the more advanced professors, as far as I can tell, of biblical theology, not just tearing down the Bible, but believing that all of its stories have deeper or metaphorical meanings in some way, and yet still has not arrived at the idea that the Bible could have the human side that's not literally true and yet still be a divine book because of the deeper meanings enfolded within it.
Exactly. Right, thank you. Laura?
Couple things on that note. One is, I remember, you know, growing up as a teenager when, you know, Jesus people and all that stuff were coming through the schools and through the colleges, I felt like I didn't know my Bible because all the parts that they were talking about were pretty much the epistles. And what we're saying this morning is without the inner meaning, so many of the stories that we love so much, like the Noah story, they don't know what to do with them. You know, they do just seem like kids' stories.
Exactly.
The other thing is, or another, I actually thought of the third thing, my husband was brought up Catholic, and he never learned any of the Bible stories. You know, was headed for the priesthood at one point in his childhood, never knew the biblical stories. Our readings at home, I mean, always came nudely to him because that wasn't something that was part of his very rigorous religious ed.
Exactly.
The other fun thing, I had a piano teacher my kids had for about 17 years between the bunch of them. Her husband's a minister, and he got talking to me one day, and I ended up bringing him one of my dad's sermons or lectures from Freiburg or something, and he came to me next week and said, this man's a genius. He was so excited. I mean, we were in his book room with the piano, and he had just a wall of books of interpretation of the Bible, but this stuff was so exciting to him.
Yes, thank you. George.
Back in a sense to Guard's question, it does strike me as questionable, let's say, to spend so much time at a seminary on the Bible without ever dealing with the question, is this a revelation or not? And ideological criticism in general seems to assume that in some way this book is normative and it's important, but it never faces why.
Exactly.
And this is, intellectually, I find this is shabby. That if it isn't normative, if it's just a lot of stories by old people, then why bother? Why spend so much of the curriculum on it? If it's normative,
exactly,
then give a basis for its being normative.
I agree with that. I would make one comment that this is Pacific School of Religion, and most of the other seminaries within the consortium are not biblical institutes. Given the rigorous academic program of 84 units within a 3-year period, not to mention the 21 additional units that are required for the Swedenborgian House of Studies, and all the activities like camp and convention and things like that, the only thing that is really required of us is one course on Old Testament and one course on New Testament. And that's basically the only thing that we have. And of course, we are very much looking forward to you being our exegesis teacher in the fall, as in 2 weeks. And all of us within the House of Studies are very much looking forward to your guidance and your knowledge. And we very much thank you, sir. Lee?
Following up on what George just said, I found Marcus Borg's explanation or whatever it was of why we should read the Bible. I mean, this was somewhat implied as being fairly weak. What I've gathered so far is what he basically said is these are the stories of how people in our ancient religious tradition, the roots of our culture, saw God. And it gives you some reason to read it. Yes, it's part of our tradition, but why should we in particular go for that tradition? Why shouldn't we read the Bhagavad Gita or the Upanishads or the Quran? I didn't find a highly convincing reason why we should particularly focus so much attention on the Bible in there. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that part of the reason for that is that they just haven't come up with one.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You can't teach or say or think what you haven't thought of.
Exactly.
And even though Swedenborg was writing a couple hundred years ago, I think he came up with some things that many professors of biblical theology just have never conceived of.
Exactly. I agree with you wholeheartedly. I believe I see the hook coming this way. So I'd like to close at this time, and I thank you for your kind attention. Oh, I'm sorry.